Welcome to the Irish Tech News Podcast, where we will bring you some of the most interesting interviews and features from the world of tech. Visit irishtechnews.ie and check out our podcast section to explore all of our previous episodes. You can subscribe to our podcast using whatever your favorite app or service is by visiting anchor.fm/irish-tech-news. And now, a word from our sponsor, AgoraPulse. We know how hard it is to juggle all the things in your business. Accounts, meetings, the never-ending inbox. That's why we've teamed up with AgoraPulse to give you more than 5 hours back a week when it comes to managing your social media marketing. No complicated Excel docs, long emails, or millions of open tabs. Simply manage all your social media channels in one place. Go to www.agorapulse.com/irishtechnews. To get 1 month free. Now all you have to do is figure out how you want to spend those spare 5 hours.
Hi, so today on the Irish Tech News Podcast, we've just reviewed a book by this author, and so it's great to have him on. And the book is called World for Sale. It's got some really good reviews, as well as by us, but some other outlets too. So first of all, who do we have the pleasure of talking to today?
Javier Blas, one of the co-authors.
Awesome. And look, Javier, thanks for coming on. Just briefly, for those who don't know what you do, how would you describe what you do now? Because you have covered a few areas.
Well, I am the chief energy correspondent for Bloomberg News in London, and I usually write about oil, metals and food, and in particular, how those markets and industries intersect with politics and global politics. So that's kind of, money, power, and natural resources all combined.
Mm-hmm. And so in doing the research to chat with you, you were on the Africa desk for a period of time. So has the idea for writing this book been germinating for even a few decades now? Because you'd have been out and you'd have seen commodity usage and exchange, and maybe different ways that commodities were being moved out of countries. Like, I guess, what inspired you to write the book?
Well, one inspiration was my very beginnings in journalism about 20, a bit more than 20 years ago. We're all getting older. And I was starting covering the industry, and I always thought, God, there is not a single book that tells you the history of the industry. You don't have a go-to book that will tell you everything. And I always have that thought. And as I travel more and more, and you are right, for a time when I was at the Financial Times, I also was the head of the Africa desk. And I went to all, a lot of the African countries and the Middle East, Latin America, and I saw the impact of commodities in local politics, et cetera, et cetera. I thought more and more about writing the book. And at some point, I think that I stopped just complaining that no one has wrote this book that I wanted, that kind of go-to book if you were interested in natural resources and politics, and to decide, well, actually, rather than complaining that no one has done it, maybe what I should be doing is start to ask why I'm not writing it. So along came Jack Fatty, my friend and colleague and co-author, and together about 4 years ago, we really started thinking very seriously about the proposal. And then, fast forward to now, the book is just out.
Yeah. And so, it's a good read. It's interesting. At times, with the different companies and the evolution from Cargill and the other guys, it would feel like you would need an atlas to just keep track. It's a bit like risk or something. Did you have that sense of the very? It really seems to show how global this business has been.
Yes, I mean, a lot of the commodity trading houses are present on almost every country that you could think of the planet. I mean, I think that with few exceptions like North Korea and perhaps places like Yemen, they are literally everywhere. And our traveling, Jack and I think that we have traveled to more than 100, 125 countries, anything from, Iraq during the war to Peru and Bolivia to Russia and Kazakhstan, China, et cetera, et cetera. It's true. This is a global business. It just has presence everywhere. And this is one of the interesting things about this industry. If you think about the globalization and how the world, to use the cliche, became flat, commodity traders really helped to flatten the world, just trading from from one corner of the world to another corner.
Yeah, yeah. Like you say, I mean, and you begin in an almost James Bond kind of way where, you know, the guy is flying in and being guided in by a drone. You touch on in the book that ways of doing business in the 70s and 80s are no longer possible. Is that very much definitively the case? Would it be no longer possible to do some of the things in the way they did it? Like I guess, is the change substantive or just superficial?
I think it has been a substantive change, but there is still behaviors that are very surprising and illegal, even, you know, very recently. So yes, the industry in the 60s and 70s, it was a lot about bribery, and you talk to the traders back then, and they acknowledge that you know, brown envelopes with full of wads of cash changed hands many, many times, and that's how contracts in emerging markets were signed and secure. And has that ended? I think that to a great extent it has, but is it still, are they still examples where the industry is misbehaving? Absolutely. I mean, you know, very recently, Vitol, the world's largest oil trader, admitted to have paid bribes in three Latin American countries. And this behavior was not 10 or 20 years ago. What they admitted is that they were doing it as recently as July last year. So has the industry changed? Yes. Are they examples about yesterday of misbehaving? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in the book, you do kind of elaborate on this, that as some of the companies evolved and the leadership changed, when the new round of leadership came in, they knew that in some ways they were going to have to do things differently to how it came before. But at the same time, so then the question is like, and you elaborate that in some countries and some cultures, bribes are still much more common, whereas in other areas, you just, bribes are not how you do things. So how do they navigate their path depending on the local cultural mores, you know?
Well, I think that some companies just decide not to do business in certain places. They know that the cost of business on those places is to have to pay, and they will just simply not go there. As a matter of business principle. So yes, there is common that some commodity traders say, well, if you want to do business in this part of the world, you need to pay. But, you know, that's their choice. You do not need to be in that part of the world. You may decide that you actually don't want to do that business just because you think that A, is illegal, but also is unethical. And I think that we are seeing some companies taking that way. And because the industry has got under pressure from regulators and lawmakers, and particularly the U.S. Department of Justice has been putting quite a lot of pressure on the industry, I think that things are beginning to change. I mean, one big change that we have seen as we were reporting and researching our book is previously a lot of, in particular, oil traders will use what we call agents to do deals in certain parts of the world, particularly Central Asia and Africa. These agents are, freelancers who work for a trading house, and they put a bit of a layer in between the politicians and the businessmen in the local country and the trading house. And we have discovered that a lot of times, a lot of bad things going on with the agents. So many trading houses have announced that they will not use agents anymore, that when they are doing businesses in difficult countries, they will go themselves to do it, and therefore trying to keep things clean.
Yeah, and that would seem to reflect like the clothing industry and other areas where previously Western companies would say, well, we didn't know they were doing it, whereas the supply chain is being analyzed further the whole way along, so that it's not acceptable to just say, oh, well, our agent didn't tell us that. So I have a question which I get the sense through the book that it would be oversimplistic to say that some of the things, it would be oversimplistic to say in the past it was completely unethical, because often sometimes it meant that some groups were able to trade with the world despite embargoes and blockades. So do you feel that it's more nuanced? And I guess what I'm wondering is did commodity traders at times actually bring some good to areas, or was it always just a one-way exchange in terms of large amounts of raw materials for very low prices, or did they do any good as well?
No, for sure they did good, and we do need commodity traders. They're an important actor on the global economy, and they are by taking risks and then obviously profiting from that risk taking, they make the world economy more efficient. They move commodities from areas of surplus when those commodities are being produced and perhaps not consumed, and they move it to consumption areas, and they finance that trade, which is humongous. And they obviously also build some of the infrastructure that is needed for that trade. So they will build ports and storage facilities and pipelines, et cetera, et cetera. So the traders play a big function for the global economy. And in general, they are a force for good, because we do need someone to arbitrage that commodity. I have just a cup of coffee here at my desk, and I'm not going to be the one who is going to go to Nicaragua in Central America to negotiate a supply for the coffee beans. It's just going to be, you know, a commodity trader is going to do that for me, and then it's just going to go to probably a coffee company, et cetera, et cetera. So they provide a service for all of us. Have they, in the past, as you said, sometimes used abuse of the system? Yes, and they saw historically embargoes and particularly in the 80s, the 70s and 80s, they saw that as trading opportunities. That is changing, obviously, and now also those embargoes are more thoroughly enforced by countries, so they don't have that ability to bypass them as they have in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's changed. I guess the one thing about, and you mentioned that, you know, like the Obama administration used, economic might to enforce things. Now, on one hand, that could be a force for good. But if it's just to implement, to make companies bend to US policy, on one hand, that you could be holding companies to higher ethical standards. On the other hand, they could just be using this to make them adhere to US policy goals.
Yeah, no, you are absolutely right. I mean, we have seen a good example of that will be Cuba. The commodity traders were very much involved in trading with Cuba, buying Cuban sugar, which was for many years the main export of the island until tourism took off, and supplying in particular oil, because after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Cuba was very short of crude oil. Previously was supplied by Moscow at a discounted prices. And obviously that trade was not seen or welcome, was not welcomed by the United States, but European countries have no problem with that trade because, it was okay for everyone. Europe have a different attitude towards Cuba that the United States had. But there are areas where most Western countries, I would think, agree. I mean, places like dealing with Saddam Hussein in the early 2000s and early and late 90s, helping Saddam Hussein to evade United Nations embargoes. Those areas, they have quite a lot of consensus on global policy making across many countries. I mean, Iraq in particular, it was a UN embargo. It was not a US policy. It was a United Nations embargo, and the traders were instrumental in helping Saddam Hussein to evade and bypass the embargo.
Yeah, look, you're right. I mean, and previously with South Africa, you know, it did help to nudge the needle to get the regime to change once there was Western pressure on banks not banking there. So you've written the book that you wanted to see because it wasn't out there. What trends might we see in the future? How's this potentially going to play forwards now? Are we still going to have commodity trading but with higher ethical standards, or will it be, you know, nuance between what they can do and what they can get away with? What trends do you see coming?
I think that in general it's going to be with higher ethical standards. I think that companies have learned lessons from the past and they are promising to do things differently. I suppose that there will be some traders who will always be very close to the wind, perhaps coming from China. I mean, we see today the Chinese trade has been very aggressive, particularly in the Middle East and in Africa. a big change that is coming for the industry is climate change. At the end of the day, a lot of the companies that we wrote about in the World for Sale, they're engaged in trading natural resources which are not great for our planet, oil, every kind of refined product from oil, and coal, lots of coal. So, you know, as the world moves to try to reduce our consumption of fossil fuels, because they contribute to climate change, I think that we will see the traders having to change their business model. They may have other opportunities. There will be some metals, for example, that are going to be needed to power the green economy. Think about cobalt or lithium for electric cars, batteries. But it's going to be a big challenge for the industry.
Yeah, you're right. And yet at the same time, from Chile and stuff, the raw materials for lithium is in short supply and will be really needed for the renewables. So yeah, I think so. What are your sources of inspiration and information? How do you stay in touch and who inspires you?
Well, you know, obviously for the book, it was very important to go to primary sources. So we talked to more than 100 traders, both current and former. So it was very interesting, particularly to talk and get an oral history from some of the traders who were active very early in the days of the 50s and 60s. Some of them are now 90 years old plus, and getting their information and their anecdotes was very interesting. And then Jack and I spent a huge amount of time digging financial reports, corporate structures, and all kind of legal documents of the commodity trading houses on all kind of places. I mean, London and Ireland were among the easy ones. A lot of time spent on the corporate registry in Switzerland and in places like Bermuda, Cayman Islands, Cyprus, Singapore, Dubai, etc., etc. And then we read everything that, you know, has been written. And there is a book to me that it was a model for exposing and revealing an industry that many people knew very little, is Merchants of Grains. It's a book about the agricultural commodity traders that was written in the 1970s. And to me, it's a classic. And I have read and reread many, many times over the last few years.
Yeah, and like you say, I mean, there has been some good stuff in the past that does point the way in terms of good investigative journalism and the stories that need to be told. Look, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. How can people learn more about what you do and your work?
Well, they can go online. They need to search for The World for Sale in any of the online retailers. If you like Amazon, Amazon. If not, go for your local bookshop now that they really need our support after lockdown is lifted, and buy the book. It's out there in the UK and Europe, and it came out recently also in North America. So please just buy it, read it, enjoy it.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Javier.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Agora Pulse. We know how hard it is to juggle all the things in your business. Accounts, meetings, the never-ending inbox. That's why we've teamed up with Agora Pulse to give you more than 5 hours back a week when it comes to managing your social media marketing. No complicated Excel docs, long emails, or millions of open tabs. Simply manage all your social media channels in one place. Go to www.agorapulse.com/IrishTechNews. To get 1 month free. Now all you have to do is figure out how you want to spend those spare 5 hours. Thank you for listening to the latest Irish Tech News podcast. Check back every day for the latest episode. You can follow us on Twitter @Irish_TechNews, on Facebook, facebook.com/IrishTechNews, on LinkedIn, linkedin.com/company/Irish-Tech-News, on Instagram, instagram.com/IrishTechNews.ie, and on TikTok, tiktok.com/@IrishTechNews.